So what's the Book of Acts about? The Book of Acts is about a bunch of people struggling like myself, messy like myself, trying to figure it out like myself, and sometimes doing it well and sometimes not doing it well at all. But underneath, what these people wanted was to love God and to figure out how to tell other people about God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, I don't know if you know this, but when I was going to college, I took a pretty extensive course in Christian education. And one of the books we studied was the Book of Acts. Actually, we looked at it really, really differently than you and I have looked at it. The way we looked at it was as kind of a handbook to tell the church what it should look like, the kinds of things it should be doing. And that doesn't look like the direction that you've taken us at all.
Right. Yeah, it's not.
But today we're going to talk about how should we look at the Book of Acts? How should it guide our faith? And my question is, does it have any relevance in terms of how we should structure our church?
Okay. My short answer is, I think, no. But maybe you could fill in a little bit more. So what sorts of things were they saying in that course? What were they... Well, I imagine they were deriving what they called principles or something from the Book of Acts.
They were, and I wish you hadn't asked that question because I don't have a clue.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a long
time ago.
Well, not that long ago. Not as old as you, but yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember other than they kind of gave us 3-point outlines on what the church should look like in various areas.
Okay, so the underlying assumption, in any case, the underlying assumption is a very common one, and that is that we come to the Book of Acts, or any other New Testament books for that matter, a lot of the epistles as well, but Acts is really a key book in this regard, that we come to something like the Book of Acts, and we assume from the outset that the author, like Luke here, or Paul or Peter, they have in mind that church just is a particular kind of thing. And our job is to shape and mold our institutions and our communities and our cultures to make sure that they conform to what God intended. And how do we know what God intended? Well, we go right back to the beginning where the church started. They had it right, and then, of course, it's deteriorated since then, but they had it right, so we need to go right back to the beginning and mold and shape our cultures and churches and communities to conform to the right principles.
Well, most definitely. That's the pattern, and we need to follow it.
Yeah.
And our work is to figure out what the Book of Acts is telling us to do.
Right.
You know, that's such a different perspective on how I look at my faith now. It's not what do I do, but how do I see the world differently? And that perspective that I learned in college was, what do I do? What are the activities that God wants me involved in such that I'm pleasing Him? And I've got this whole different perspective is, how do I look at the world? How do I look at myself? How do I look at you?
Mm-hmm. And with respect to this particular issue, there's an additional difference, and that is, for me, I would imagine you share this view as well, that for me, it used to be, what is Christianity about? Well, it's about a lot of things, but one of the central things it's about is doing church.
And, oh, absolutely.
And now I've completely rejected that. I mean, I've seen how irrelevant that is to what the New Testament is all about, to what the gospel is all about, to what God is all about. It's not about doing church. It's about my individual relationship with God and its implications for how I relate to other people and the world and stuff like that. But But it's really not about getting my church right.
Church falls into place there somewhere, but it isn't the main focus.
Right. Let me give a little background, because I think I know where that came from. One, I think it's just human that we like to, what we human beings create, our institutions, our structures are important to us, and we have an inflated view of their value and their importance. So that's partly what plays into our idea that Christianity is about church.
Well, you know, Jack, it gives us something to hold on to. It's tangible.
Yeah.
We can feel it. We can see it. We can know it. It's so much different than if I'm going to treat you in a responsible way, if I'm going to, like we said last week, look at this fork in the road, a decision I can make to be selfish or to be giving to you. And it's so much easier to decide if I'm going to go to church or if I'm going to be making a decision that really kind of is some kind of risk or takes some courage from me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember having a conversation once. I was at a stage in my life where I had just moved to a new location, and I wasn't really tied in with a church yet. I would visit churches occasionally, but I hadn't really kind of attached myself to a church and said, this is my church. And I was talking to another gentleman who was concerned about me. He was concerned that that I hadn't really landed and become a member of any church. And in the course of this conversation, he said at one point, I don't remember all that he said in the whole context, but the line that stands out in my memory is, I'm a churchman. And he repeated that a number of times in our conversation. I'm a churchman. And
like that's something that gives me stamina with God. That's something that gives me backbone with God.
Right.
That's what's most important.
And what I discerned is that he was actually defining his Christianity. He was defining his faith itself in terms of his loyalty to this institution, his loyalty to this structure. And I've grown a lot, and I know a lot more now than I did then. But even at the time, even though then I probably would have been a lot more open and amenable to that point of view, it just struck me as really odd. I mean, if I were going to boil down, you know, here's a Christian man boiling down his faith to, I am a churchman. And I thought, well, maybe a Jesus freak, maybe, or a follower of Jesus, or a child of God, or, I mean, there's a lot of other things come to mind first before a churchman. And it was so odd. It struck me as so odd that it really started me thinking about that. Yeah, what are we doing here? What is this all about? Is this about church, or is this about, you know, discipleship? Me as an individual coming to terms with who I am and what I am in relationship to God. And I've gone the other direction. I've gone the direction of thinking it's about my own personal odyssey in relationship to God, primarily, fundamentally. We can talk about what role church has in that, but it's not about building a church. It's not about doing church. It's not about being loyal to a church. It's about learning to know God and love Him.
Now, I think I should add here that you might kind of sound like a church hater, someone who really doesn't believe that church has any place. But for those who maybe haven't listened to us before who don't know this, you happen to be the pastor of a church.
Right, that's true.
Which is kind of an irony. Can you help us understand that?
Well, because I believe very definitely that there is a role for church. And what it really comes down to, I think, is in this odyssey, in this struggle, this fight that we all have to keep the faith and to hold on to our faith and to persevere in our faith, the world around us can be very seductive, and it can be very blinding. It can lead me away from a clear, focused recognition of what life is supposed to be all about. If I'm out there all by myself in the midst of that fight and that struggle, with no one who sees clearly what life is all about, it can be very treacherous. So we need to be exhorting one another. We need to be teaching one another. We need to be encouraging one another. We need to be persuading one another. I liken it. I mean, when people have at times come and lent me their eyes is the way I like to describe it. You know, they're at a situation in their life where their vision is clear, their faith is strong, is stable. And by talking to me, they can say, here's what it looks like to me. I mean, here's what it's all about, Jack. You know, here's who God is. Here's what's important. Here's what's valuable. When I'm confused, you know, when I'm not seeing clearly what is valuable and what is important, and they remind me and they tell me. I was talking to a young woman the other day, and I was giving her some counsel, some encouragement about how she was relating to other people. And she said, well, I know all that. And it just struck me, the most helpful times in my life have been when people have been telling me things that 2 weeks before I was teaching from the pulpit, telling me things that I have known and taught for years. But it doesn't make any difference that I know it intellectually. I need to see life that way. I need to perceive life that way. And that's where we need one another. Because when Satan, the Sandman, throws his sand in my eyes and I can't see any longer, I need someone to help me find my way. And fundamentally for me, that's church. Through the teaching that we offer, through the mutual relationships where encouragement and persuasion can happen, that's why we need church, is a community that of like-minded people, people who believe the gospel, believe the truth, hunger and thirst after righteousness, desire to know God and to seek Him, a community of people who will support me in that quest rather than lead me away from that.
How I used to see church was that I needed to go because that was God's requirement, and that if I don't go, I'm in trouble. And I think I'm really a lot closer to what you're talking about now. I want to go because I'm recognizing a need in myself for that encouragement, to get back on track, to understand things that I might have been told a lot of times, but I need to be told again, because there's a lot of messages out there that tell me different than what you're going to tell me in church.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a positive going toward rather than a rule that I'm obeying.
Right, right. Yeah, that was my experience as well. What complicates it is, having been a pastor for a number of years now in one context or another, I also understand the pressure and the temptation that pastors feel. It takes an incredibly mature and an incredibly secure and incredibly confident person to be able to let people be served or not served as they want. To come or not come. And if
I don't know if you can necessarily have the qualification of being secure. I don't know if that is necessarily what lots of pastors come with, but I think they may have to learn through the insecurity of members not doing what looks good to them.
Right, right.
And kind of have to constantly live with that and, I don't know, did I just say it? Grow and learn from it.
Right.
And maybe never not feel insecure.
Right, yeah. But at least know how to put that insecurity in its proper light and its proper proportion and act accordingly.
Yeah, rather than demand that you come so that I make sure and have the right attendance that week, I don't demand you come and I might have a really low attendance,
right,
for example.
Exactly. And it seems to me that happens a lot. I mean, that's where you and I got the message in our younger years that God's not going to be happy with you unless you come. Why? Because there was some pastor out there who needed to give you that message to scare you into coming and to attend. It's really his own agenda. It's not really about God. It's about him. And I see the temptation. I see people succumbing to that temptation. Early on, my mentors, one of the things I really appreciate very much about what they taught me, they probably said it better than I will be able to repeat it here, but they taught me not to be jealous about the people that you're teaching. In fact, their view was that people will kind of come into the sphere of influence of your teaching. They will learn what they have to learn from you, and then God will take them on somewhere else. So rather than as they begin to leave and go out the door, rather than reach out and grab them and, you know, try to pull them back into the sphere of your teaching, to be loyal to you as you are tempted to do, let them go. They don't belong to you. They belong to God. They're God's children. And there are things that you can't teach them that they're going to have to learn elsewhere in some other way from somebody else or whatever. And, you know, don't protect them from that other education that they can get from other people. Let God be their guardian. Let God be their shepherd. Let God protect them. You just let them go, and you be available, and you be accessible to serve and to pass on what wisdom you do have. But let them take it or leave it.
That's really serving God and not serving yourself. And that's
so.
A tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very tough.
Well, I'm thinking one of the scary things might be that they go to this other church and they find that this pastor actually teaches better than I do, or does counseling better than I do, or somehow the ministry is more effective in that person's life, and they'll come back to me and say, I'm disappointed in you.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a tough one.
Mm-hmm. And that's happened to me. That's happened to me a number of times. And again, we have to come, you have to grow. You have to come to the point where you can say, well, actually, yeah, they do teach better than I do. Or they do such and such better than I do. Or at the very minimum, they teach in a way that's more accessible to that particular person, and that person can get more out of that. I mean, I'm painfully aware that my teaching is not for everybody, because I can only do what I can do, and if that doesn't connect with a particular person, I'm not much use to them. And it's a serious limitation on the impact that I can have. But can I live with that? Can I accept that? Can I accept the fact that God has made me who He's made me, has made me be someone who can serve a certain set of people and not a whole lot of other people? I need to be able to accept that. I mean, it would be foolish of me not to accept that. I just am what I am. And God has given me the role and the function that He's given me. It's no greater than that, and it's no less than that. It just is what it is. And coming to terms with that and accepting that is part of the wisdom that we all need to learn just across the board in life, is that I have the life God has given me, and I shouldn't pound against the boundaries and hate what God has made my life and learn to accept it instead.
Well, you hit upon something really big there, because I think that's the problem with all of us, is we hit across against the boundaries that God has set for our lives, and I would like to be different than who I am in lots of ways. I wish that, you know, my circumstances were different in lots of ways, mm-hmm. and to accept those limitations, to accept what He has for me, and to know that's His plan, both in my character, in my person, in my skills, and in my circumstances, I think is the work of life.
Yeah,
one of
is.
The huge
right.
works of life.
Yeah.
And when it hits against me in areas where I'm insecure, it's even a more difficult work.
Right.
So, Jack, I think we've gone a little far afield, as usual,
in
trying to figure out what the book of Acts says about our faith. How should we look at it? How should we approach it? How can it help us?
Yeah, okay. And so, we were using the example of church. Does it, for example, give us a blueprint for doing church? No, I don't think it does, because the book of Acts is about this incredible moment in human history that we've talked about in past programs, where...
I think you called it spiritual global warming.
Yeah, spiritual global warming. Where God has poured out His Spirit and is beginning to do just this radically new thing in the world, to bring about a relatively high degree of enlightenment relative to the rest of human history. It's about the eyes of people being opened to see the truth of the gospel. It's not about establishing a church. And I realize that's a very controversial claim. There are all kinds of people who would just vehemently disagree with me on that, but I can't see it any other way. I don't think it's about the building of the church. It's about the coming of truth into the world and the various sorts of impact that truth coming into the world has had on human history. And that's what it's about. So when you look at what the apostles did, Paul is not going into the town and he's not thinking, okay, I went up on the mountain and God gave me a blueprint for how to build a church, so now I'm going to go into this town of Iconium and I'm going to plant a church here. And here's what it's going to look like, and here's how I'm supposed to do it, and here are the steps, and when I'm done, this is what this thing should look like. Quite the contrary, in the book of Acts we see all kinds of evidence that when Paul went into a community and people became believers, Jews and Gentiles, and you formed this little nucleus of a community of people who were like-minded and who were encouraging one another and persuading one another. And when it came time to organizing, Paul simply went to the only organization that he knew, the synagogue, and said, well, at the synagogue, we organize this way, so let's do that. So the idea of elders and deacons and an eldership, a group of elders to kind of oversee things, is what you would have had at the synagogue, in the Jewish synagogue. It's not because God had shown him the blueprint on the mountain for how to do church. He just thought, this could be effective. This could work. So
he appoints
elders.
And I think underneath that is the bigger thing, Jack. It's Paul, Barnabas, the apostles were really excited about what they'd heard from Jesus. They were astounded buy it, and they wanted to share it, and they were just trying to figure out what's the best way to do this.
Right.
There's lots of ways to do that. But I think if we have the heart of, I want to know God, I want to share God, then any kind of structure can come out of that. And the interesting thing about Acts is that it's kind of a mundane book in some ways. I mean, in some ways it's astonishing, like the miracles are amazing. But, you know, there's lots of just missionary journeys and people that didn't get along with each other or who did get along with each other and just kind of trying to trek through life and trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured out a structure, but it was guided again by this theme underneath. I want to know God. I want to share God.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And we get lost. We get into the details and make that more important. And
right.
We get lost in, gosh, where are we really going? What's really important here?
Mm-hmm. And so what we lose track of in our lostness, we just try to glom onto something and just have it be fixed and say, well, this is just it. This is the way it's done. Instead of recognizing that I think the apostles would have seen this as far more plastic. That is, well,
pliable?
Pliable, moldable, moldable, malleable, that we can shape it to fit our situation. I mean, it's not that there's one and only one right way to do church. There's a lot of different cultures and a lot of different kind of people and a lot of different situations. As long as the underlying driving love of the truth and pursuit of the gospel is there, then express it however you will. You know, put it in whatever form that makes sense and is rational and is wise in the light of what this is ultimately all about.
And you know what I'm thinking, Jack, is that that's a really good argument for having a lot of different churches. Because we are really different in our personalities and in the way we want to express how we know God and see God and how we want to share Him. And we actually go to churches that match our personality, that help us do that best.
Mm-hmm.
And having a lot of choices is a good thing. And I think the problem comes when we start saying, it's got to be my way. Or for me to judge you and say, the way you express your faith by having a lot of worship songs really isn't very important to me, because I don't really like worship songs, so really you're kind of bad and you're not mature. Well, that's really, we were talking about this a lot several weeks ago, that's such a wrong way of looking at it. If that's the way my heart responds to God, and that's real and that's true, then that's a good thing.
Right.
I think we need to, though, go down to the bottom of what's real and what's true. Lots of times we don't go there. We just paste on a thing that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get lost in the things that we're doing, and we judge each other for the things that other people are doing or not doing.
Right, right. Exactly. It is true that one of the things that's going to be a very common phenomenon is we're going to gravitate toward those churches that appeal to certain things in my personality at the expense of the gospel and the truth and that underlying driving unity that ought to bind every believer together. That's always going to be a temptation, and that's always going to be a reality. But as long as the love of the truth and the desire to know God and seek God is the underlying driving force within a community, nothing else really matters. You know, how we express that and our outward form and our structure and our look and our, as you put it, our personality really doesn't make any difference then. And we should be able to love one another across those differences and accept one another across those differences.
But what we do need to look for is people who are seekers of truth.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know, this just occurs to me, so let me put it out here. And sometimes people say, how do I choose a husband? And I think you answered that question for somebody. Somebody told me about it the other day. And one of the things you said is, well, do you want to marry that person? Is it something you're just drawn to? And that's pretty simple. But I think another thing is that person drawn to reality and to truth?
Right.
And are they teachable?
Right.
And that's what we need to look for in our husbands and wives. And that's what we need to look for in our friends and in our churches.
Right.
And everything else doesn't really make that much difference, because even if my husband is a person that's very, very different from me, and we have a lot of difficulty in living life because of that, what will give us a common bond is we're trying to seek for truth, and we're trying to live that responsibly, and that makes it good. Not that we ever get on the same page doing the same things, other than we're on the same page trying to pursue what's good and love each other in the midst of it.
Right, Right.
You with me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was the other thing I noticed among my mentors, that they would look with favor upon this Roman Catholic over here, or this Episcopalian over here, or this Lutheran over here, or this Presbyterian over here, because they recognized a unity. They recognized the same spirit, the same truth-seeking in them, and wisdom born of their experience and their study and so on. It didn't matter that they weren't one of us, you know, that they didn't belong to our church or our denomination or our whatever. And so I had a lot of models before me of people who weren't at all chauvinistic about their particular church, denomination, institution, or what movement or whatever. And that was a very good, I mean, that was very helpful to me early on to have that model for me.
It's an incredible heritage you have, and I think it's maybe what started you on the path of perhaps being able to let go of other people who are going in other directions.
Right.
Because you can see value in other people's methods and other people's lives and other people's
truth in other people's doctrines, you know, in their different doctrines, that nobody has a corner on the truth, nobody has it all right, nobody has it all wrong, you know, that gives me the comfort to know that people can be okay and not be one of us, you know, or one of me, a clone of me.
So Jack, what is it that makes me want people to be clone of me?
Well, one thing, you can probably answer this better than I can, but one thing that does occur to me, I'm not sure how to articulate this, but we often like to get people to come to our church or to come to this Bible study or come to this event as a kind of vote for my choices, a vote of confidence in my choices.
Oh, I think it's more than that. I think it's a validation in who I am.
Yeah, right.
Because I don't believe in who I am.
Exactly.
Underneath, I'm lonely and scared and messed up, and I don't want to see that. And if you tell me I'm good by sticking around, then I don't have to know that. Yeah, I don't have to see the truth of myself.
I at least have one person outside of myself who knows that I'm valuable.
And man, I want more than one. I want to gather as many as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And it keeps me kind of blind to the reality of my own fears, my own sinfulness, my own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps me manipulating other people in order to meet my needs in the name of God.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's scary.
I mean, I know the self-doubt that comes when you've been going to a church and you're really excited about this church, and then somebody decides, you know what, I don't know what they'll say, I'm not having my needs met here, or I don't like this anymore, I'm going over to this other church instead. And that incredible gripping sense of self-doubt that I experience, it shouldn't affect me. I mean, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Why do I care so much whether they come to the church that I'm coming to? And I think it's exactly what you've said, is I don't have enough confidence in my own choice and my own identity as defined by my choices that it threatens me. I really get threatened that, well, are they saying I'm wrong in my choice? Are they saying I'm bad or superficial or not hip? You know, what are they saying?
They're saying maybe something's wrong with me, and I don't want to hear that maybe something's wrong, or maybe they see something wrong, so I'll make them bad, really, and maybe criticize the direction they're going in.
Right.
You know, Jack, something that occurs to me is that when you're up there speaking in church or teaching, I never get from you this underlying insecurity, these questions that come out, like when you're on the soccer field, you've talked about before, and what a jerk you can be, or how scared you are sometimes maybe when people leave, or how it kind of nudges parts of you that really are scared. And it's really helpful to hear that you are like me, that we are all like each other on the same playing field. We all are scared, and you don't express it in a way that's very obvious. And so for you to say it outright is a really helpful thing.
Well, yeah, I've had plenty of struggles over the years. It's through those things that we learn. I mean, we as we get to know ourselves, we get to know what sin is, because that's what we are. And as we get to know sin, then we can begin to see it in its proper perspective and see the difference between what we ought to be and what we are. I've had plenty of experience with that.
So, Jack, before our time goes completely, I wonder if there's a few points that you'd like to outline for us in terms of how to really look at the Book of Acts. One of the things that we're saying here is that it's not a book of principles of how to do a church. It's not a book of principles of how to live our lives. What exactly do we do? What are the forms that it takes? Underneath, it's a book that says, I love God and I want to share that with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that we need to
that one point, I think, that's important, but it has a lot of different implications. One of them is, what is a church supposed to look like? Another one is, what are our lives supposed to look like? And what do we see in the book of Acts? Well, we see people becoming believers and being baptized and being and speaking in tongues. Well, is that what our lives should look like then? Well, no, not necessarily. Not if we understand what's going on in Acts. That is, this is a turning point in human history. God is doing what he's doing then. That's not necessarily what he's always going to do in every believer's life throughout all time. We have people like Philip and Peter and Paul being apparently hearing messages from the Spirit of God. They describe it as being led by the Spirit of God. Is that what the normal believer should experience? Well, not necessarily. In fact, the thing that was most striking to me the other day, I don't know why I didn't notice it earlier, why it wasn't obvious to me, but I racked my brain to find any example in the book of Acts of somebody who's neither an evangelist, a prophet, or an apostle, identified as having that role, who has any miracle occur in their life in the book of Acts. I mean, where are the miracles happening? Paul, Peter, Philip, Barnabas, this great man, not a single miracle is recorded in his life. Maybe on the day of Pentecost, he was one who experienced the speaking in tongues and the flames of fire and stuff on the day of Pentecost with all those other people, but that was sort of an unusual mass miracle. But you never have Barnabas said that he was led by the Spirit or he prophesied or any of these things. And yet we so readily look at Acts and we take the accounts of these unusual events, these miracles or these prophecies or these revelations or these leadings by the Spirit, and we say, well, see, that's the normal Christian life. I mean, back in the old days, back in the early church, every one of these believers was being led by the Spirit and having revelations from God and prophesying and having miracles happen. Well, you can't even read Acts and prove that, let alone jump from then to today. Because all we really know for sure is that the apostles experienced that, and the apostolic community, the larger apostolic community, including the prophets and the evangelists. But your plain old ordinary Lydia doesn't, none of those experiences are reported or recorded with respect to her. All these obscure names, these ordinary people, Luke is never recorded as having any of these miracles or doing any of these miracles. He is a traveling partner with Paul. Paul's the one that has the vision that says go to Macedonia, not over here, not Luke. Luke's just along for the ride. Well, that's very striking to me when I think about it, because of our tendency to take this as a blueprint, see what is recorded, these miracles that are recorded, and then go, see, that should be normal for us today. That's how our life is. The only reason we're not experiencing all these things is because of our weakness of our faith or our hardness of heart or our stubbornness or our unbelief or something like that. Well, it doesn't really match the evidence. That's not really what the evidence suggests. Because what the evidence suggests is the apostles had a lot of remarkable things happening. That's the only thing we know for sure. Another one that's a huge example of this is in chapter 2. You'll have whole traditions that base their view of what it means to live in community based on chapter 2, verses 37 and following, right after the day of Pentecost. Let me read a section here. Now when they heard this, they were pierced to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brethren, what shall we do? These are the people who heard Peter's sermon at Pentecost. Peter said to them, repent, and each of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, and you will receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. For the promises for you and your children and for all who are far off, as many as the Lord our God will call to himself. And with many other words, he solemnly testified and kept on exhorting them, saying, be saved from this perverse generation. So then, those who had received his word were baptized, and that day they were added about 3,000 souls. they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Everyone kept feeling a sense of awe, and many wonders and signs were taking place through the apostles, interestingly, through the apostles, and all those who had believed were together and had all things in common. And they began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all as anyone might have need, day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from house to house. They were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. Well, there are some traditions who look at that and say, see, now there's real Christianity at work. That's the earliest manifestation of the church. And look, it was a commune-type society. It was a communistic-type society. They had all things in common. If somebody had some property, they'd sell it, they'd liquidate it, and they would share it with everybody else. That's the way we should live. That's the way Christianity should affect our lives. That's what our community should look like, because Acts 2 says so. Well, what they have lost sight of is what the situation is, what the context is, what the scene is. And I think I might have commented briefly on this in a past program, but we have a highly unusual situation. We have people who have traveled from all over the Roman Empire to be here to celebrate the festival of Pentecost in Jerusalem. This remarkable thing has happened. They've become believers. Their whole life has been transformed, turned on its head. They're away from home, they're away from family, they're away from their work, they're away from their business, they're away from their ordinary life. There's nothing ordinary about what they're doing right here. But they don't want to leave and go back to their ordinary life, not yet, because they can't tear themselves away from this remarkable life-transforming, history-transforming set of events that are happening. They want to sit around, they want to stay around and observe it. Well, how are they going to do that? You know, how are they going to maintain themselves? How are they going to sustain themselves? Well, they pull together and they chip in, and with what resources they do have, they share their resources to make it possible to sustain their stay, their visit in Jerusalem. That's what's going on. That's a very human thing to happen. I mean, even non-believers do this. That's what Woodstock was all about. You know, you had this rock concert, you had inadequate provision, inadequate facilities. What did they do? They all kind of pulled together and made the best of it in the midst of this torrential downpour, this thunderstorm, adverse conditions. But they pulled together for this short time to love one another and take care of one another.
Jack, I wonder if there's anybody in history who has ever compared Pentecost and Woodstock.
Probably not.
But I think what you're saying is that there is just kind of a really significant time for the people in Woodstock. It was really important to them, and they were willing to make sacrifices that maybe under normal conditions they wouldn't. And that was true for the people around the time of Pentecost. Wow, there's something exceptional happening here. Let's stay. Let's soak it in. This isn't going to happen again, and aren't we privileged to have this opportunity?
Right. And if we can't handle the comparison with Woodstock, then Hurricane Andrew, or any flood, or any earthquake, something that is just so totally disruptive of our ordinary life that we just need to survive. And look how human beings often pull together to serve one another and help one another through getting back to normal.
Yeah, we usually think about not especially wonderful times where we end up staying together because it's so wonderful we can't leave each other. I think more often we think about, you know, traumatic times when we pull together. This happened to be one of those real exceptions in history where, wow, this is a great time and we're not going to miss it.
Right.
And so what you're saying is this is not a pattern for how we live our lives throughout history. It just was an exceptional time in history. And Luke recorded... Is it Luke, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Luke recorded.
What happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was great what happened, but it's not for us necessarily to do today.
Right.
Though under some circumstances, that could be true.
Right, exactly. Because, again, let's look at the evidence of the book of Acts. Was this event in Acts 2 ever replicated again anywhere else that Christianity went in the book of Acts? No. You know, it's when Paul went into Philippi, it doesn't say... And they all held all things in common, and they spent all day long with the breaking of bread and went from house to house and so on. that was just a very, very different, bizarre, unusual event that happened in human history. Anywhere that Paul took Christianity from then on, they lived their ordinary lives. They all had their own homes. They all had their own houses. They all had their own jobs. Paul would teach daily in the lecture, first at the synagogue and then the lecture hall at Corinth or at the lecture hall at Ephesus. He would teach every lunchtime, but people were apparently taking time out of their life from their work day to come and hear him and then go back to their ordinary lives. But that's what happened mostly in the book of Acts.
So we've got to be careful when we look at the book of Acts and we don't say, hey, you know, I want a communist society, and so I'm going to find a place that justifies it. And I think that's what we do a lot of the time.
Right.
On the other hand, Jack, I think that looking at these passages and saying, wow, you know, that really is a great model, I think I want to live my life that way. There's nothing wrong with that. If underneath is this guiding principle of how do I love God and how do I express that best? And if it happens to be that I live in a commune, then that can be an okay structure.
Yeah.
It's just that
yeah.
I don't impose that on other people around me.
Right.
To have to do it my way.
Right.
Because that's not the biblical imperative.
Yeah, as long as we are wise. I mean, there are wise communes and there are communal situations that are simply trying to artificially force their lives into conformity to Acts 2, and they do really foolish things. Well, if you do really foolish things, you're going to pay the consequences of your foolishness. You run out of money, run out of resources, or whatever.
But that's true for anything. I can
right.
start a church that looks like any other church, and I can be foolish actually in the way that I do it. So
right.
I can be foolish no matter what. And so what you're saying is, no matter how I approach my relationship with God and with people, I need to do it with wisdom.
Right.
And you know what? There's a problem. Because we're really short on wisdom a lot of the time. Hey, Jack, before we end up, we have about 8 minutes, I think, of this program. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the spiritual authority of the church in people's lives. Now, we have talked about the book of Acts doesn't say the church is the institution that is above all and in all and leads all. But we haven't specifically talked about the spiritual authority of the church in people's lives. And sometimes I think the church has some really good things to say to people because they are in a position of really living with people. Other times I think that the church really takes it way too far and becomes kind of a god in and of itself, kind of a granddad to people. And so I guess I want some clarification there.
Okay. What sort of, if I'm understanding, what sort of authority does the church leadership, have in my life?
Have an individual life.
Yeah. One of the things that was most striking, I mean, I have thought this for a long time, and I've kind of worked out a theory of authority that this thing confirms, but I was really struck by this one passage in Acts. It's in chapter 15 of Acts. Let me read this section. Some men came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And when Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them, the brethren determined that Paul and Barnabas and some others of them should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders concerning this issue. The thing that was most striking to me about that is this part about when Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them. Because, I mean, as the story goes on, they go down to Jerusalem and all the apostles and elders talk this thing through and they come to the decision together that God has already spoken. I think we've talked about this in past programs. God has already spoken and God obviously has registered his vote that he thinks Gentiles can be saved without being Jews, and his vote is the only one that counts. So who are we to deny that? But that's the debate, that's the issue that's being debated in Antioch. What was striking to me is that Paul debated the issue. That's just absolutely startling to me, because we have a concept of, say, apostolic authority. Given the more normal concept of apostolic authority, if I was an apostle, I wouldn't debate the issue, I would just forbid them to speak. I'm Jack the Apostle, and I say on my authority, you are forbidden from speaking here any longer. You are not telling the truth, so get out of here. Now that's not actually my view of my own authority, but I think typically we all tend to have inherited from somewhere the idea that that's the kind of the authority the apostles had. And
that I'm in a position to tell you how it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and there's
my
no
word
question.
Is final, and the truth is settled by my opinion on this matter. But Paul feels compelled to debate with them. That is, the issue is, what does the scripture say? What have we seen? What have we evidenced? What have we witnessed? Here's where all this stuff concludes.
So are you saying that he, although he had a very strong opinion, he was still willing to be teachable, to look at the scripture, to have people question him, to review it, to make sure he was clear?
And not pull rank.
And
that's the incredible thing. He didn't pull rank here.
And of all people, Paul.
Exactly. If anybody could have.
So that should that leave us a little insecure, perhaps, that Paul didn't know, so how can we know?
No, because I think he clearly did know. It's not a question of him not knowing. It's not a question of him not being confident. But he recognized that other people need to see for themselves.
Need to think it through?
They need to think it through. They need to own this belief. And it doesn't do any good for him to just say, believe this. I'm the apostle. Believe this.
So he needed to guide them in an understanding. He needed to kind of lead their minds so they got it themselves.
Exactly.
And not just obeyed a rule.
Exactly. And that's what I think is across the board. Any authority in our churches has to be wise people persuading other people to see the wisdom in what they know. And if people won't grant them the authority that their wisdom really makes them worthy of, there's nothing. It's not my job to enforce my authority. I need to earn my authority in your life by displaying my wisdom. But you will always have the freedom to reject it. That's the thing, is that Paul is giving people the freedom here to reject his authority.
So,
he really has it, but he doesn't enforce it on
but
them.
But where we're going back to, Jack, is what we were talking about earlier, and there's this sense of humility about myself.
Mm-hmm.
I want to demand that people do what I want them to do, but that's not really serving God. That's serving me.
Exactly.
To get people to kind of build up the self-image that I don't have, to make me feel better, perhaps. So, again, here, Paul was a real model of humility.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of like we were talking about Barnabas last time.
Right. So, the implication of that with respect to, like, back to the original question about churches, doing churches, you know, do we have this principle about appointing elders, and here's the kind of authority elders have, and so on. When Paul appointed elders, what was he doing? I mean, there's two ways to look at it. One is, Paul comes to me, I'm St. Jack and Iconium, and he comes to me and says, okay, Jack, I want you to stand up here on the podium where everybody can see you. I'm going to point to you. Hey, everybody out there, here's St. Jack. I'm appointing him an elder. He's got authority now. You better listen to him. He's an elder, and he's got authority. That's one way to understand what it would mean for him to appoint elders. The other way for him to appoint me an elder would be to take me into a quiet corner of a little coffee shop in downtown Iconium and say, Jack, I've been watching you. God has been at work in your life. You are wise. You understand. You do believe. Your faith is authentic. Your faith is real. Other people out there are struggling, but I think you are well grounded in the faith. You, Jack, I think, have a responsibility to take initiative in the lives of these other people to guide them into the truth, into a more stable and a more grounded faith. I think you have the wisdom to do that. You need to take responsibility to do that. Nobody else even knows that I'm an elder on that view. It's not their business, because he's not asking me to go out and make them respond to me, make them obey me. He's not giving me a rank that I can pull on them. He's just saying, I perceive that you have given the wisdom that you have a God-given role here. You have a responsibility before God that you need to be faithful to discharge. You are a steward here of something that you need to serve God faithfully in.
He's saying, play out your role, don't pull rank.
Exactly.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
We're coming to the end of this program. We are going to go off the air at the end of March. Some of you on your radio stations will hear the last program Friday or Saturday of March, and some of you Sunday, April 1st. But we're quickly coming to an end of this program. Christine and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your participation, for being the audience that you've been, the letters that you've sent. Some of you have sent money to support this program, and we just want to take this opportunity to tell you how much we truly have appreciated interacting with you, getting to know some of you, corresponding with some of you, and being supported by you. It wouldn't have been possible without your encouragement. You sent letters explaining how much we have meant to you, and that's what kept us going, that knowledge that somebody was benefiting by what we were doing. So we want to take this last opportunity to just thank you for that.
I just so much want to echo that. I so thoroughly have appreciated people's letters that were so often written from their hearts. Sometimes there were criticisms and encouragements to do things differently, and sometimes there were just people who turned on the channel and a light came on in their life, and we got a lot of those letters where it was kind of amazing, Jack, that there were people even in prisons who our voices went to, and they heard and responded. And we are so appreciative to you guys and to God for giving us the opportunity to speak to you in ways that, about things that have meant so much to us. It is a privilege to have done that for you. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.